This podcast is brought to you by Kyoto Japan Automotive Group, a company which I've known personally for over 20 years, and your one-stop shop for tires, batteries, and auto parts. Visit their website at www.kyotojap.com for more details. My guest is Lieutenant General Retired Ben Hodges of FBH Geostrat Consulting. He's NATO's Senior Mentor for Logistics and formerly Commander of the United States Army in Europe. Just over a year since our last radio conversation, we talk about the progress of the war in Ukraine, what the West needs to do to support Ukraine better, and how politics and warfare interplay, especially in the year of an American presidential election. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, everyone. 15 months ago, that's October 2022, I interviewed for the second time my guest today. On the first occasion that I interviewed him, he and I talked just a few months after America's exit from Afghanistan in August 2021. As a very senior officer in the United States Army who'd served in Afghanistan, he gave his candid and informed views of what had gone wrong. 15 months ago, my guest spoke factually and rather optimistically about the valiant progress of Ukraine in Russia's war of aggression. At that time, Russia's attack on Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities was 8 months old, though when one includes the invasion of Crimea in 2014, Russia's occupation of Ukraine's sovereign territory was already in its eighth year. Now, if you're a regular listener, you will already have guessed that my guest today is Lieutenant General Retired Ben Hodges, a former commander of the U.S. Army in Europe and the first commander of NATO's Allied Land Command. He retired in 2018. These days, he speaks for FBH Geostrat Consulting and is a NATO senior mentor for logistics. General Hodges joins me via Zoom from Frankfurt, where he's based. And he's a regular contributor to broadcast radio and TV programs around the world and known for his straightforward and knowledgeable commentaries on war and conflict strategies, especially the war in Ukraine. Welcome back to the McKay interview, Ben. Happy New Year. I do appreciate you making time for me and our listeners when you're in such great demand.
Well, Michael, I'm grateful. I can't believe you let me come back on.
Ben, it's because of your candor and frankness that I want to start by taking you back to what you said on this program in October 2022. To ask you to comment on your predictions and remarks then, and to bring us up to date with the military scene in Ukraine as you see it through your expert eyes today.
Yeah. Well, of course, I was wrong in my assessment of how quickly I thought that Ukraine would be able to defeat Russia. I was wrong. And I have to own that. And I do get reminded almost daily by somebody that I was overly optimistic. But I have to say that where I was most overly optimistic was that I thought the United States and our allies would have embraced the necessity of Ukraine actually winning this war. And that meant, and I always caveated that Ukraine could do what I thought they could if we in the West gave them what they needed. We have consistently failed, the United States in particular, but also I would say Germany, failed to provide the specific capabilities that Ukraine needs to actually defeat Russia, win this conflict. I mean, what we hear from my president, who's otherwise done a good job, or from the German Bundeskanzler, is that we are with Ukraine for as long as it takes. What an empty, meaningless statement. And so we have continued this sort of incremental decision-making, a very slow delivery of things that Ukrainians need, but also we have refused to provide what they really need, which is long-range precision strike capability. Fortunately, UK has done it, France has done it, but the US and Germany continue to refuse it, and I don't understand why.
Well, that was my next question, Ben, but I'll ask it anyway. I mean, you've been very open and honest, but let me just put it to you. You opened the radio conversation then when we last spoke by saying to me, and I wrote down the words at the time, that war is a test of will and a test of logistics. That's what you actually said to me. You also told me that you expected Ukraine to push Russia back to those lines of February 22 and that Crimea would. But give us a little bit more insight into what has happened and why you think, in this case, the West, Germany, you live in Germany, so you must be quite close to things there. You read the local press and the United States. I know that you're in and out of the United States fairly often. Give us some insights, because we are really lay people in this area. Why the reluctance in those two countries?
I think there is this sort of narrative that some of the so-called experts, and frankly, a lot of them inside the Biden administration, the so-called Russia experts, were also the same people that were in the Obama administration that mishandled and misunderstood Russia. And they still have this notion that somehow Russia's a great country and there's just no way they can actually be defeated, or we don't, they don't, they fear what might happen if Russia's defeated, and can't imagine, what might happen if there's a regime collapse. I'm not advocating for regime collapse, but certainly that could be one of the outcomes when Ukraine finally liberates Crimea, which is the most important part of Russian-occupied Ukraine. But let's, if you'll allow me, put in context where we are, because there is a sort of undertone of defeatism that's out there that I think is completely unjustified. If you can step back for a second, and I'm glad you mentioned that the war started in 2014, not in 2022. So this has been going on now for 10 years. After 10 years, with every advantage, Russia still only controls 18% of Ukraine. They've lost over 330,000 killed and wounded in just the last 2 years.
330,000. That's the estimate, is it, Ben?
The great Russian Air Force, again, with every advantage, has failed to achieve air superiority, which is job one for any Air Force. They also have failed to interdict the lines of communication. The convoys and trains bringing ammunition and equipment from Poland into Ukraine, not one train or convoy has been stopped. The Great Black Sea Fleet, which is really a cool name, is having to withdraw from Sevastopol after just three British-provided Storm Shadows were used to hit the headquarters and maintenance facilities in the port of Sevastopol.
And just let
So,
me stop you there. For those of us who don't understand the detail and haven't got a map in front of us, when you say they withdraw, that means that the fleet physically moves further away from the coast, to put it in simple language. Is
yeah,
that?
thanks for stopping me. So of course, Storm Shadow is the excellent cruise missile that UK has provided.
Right.
And just for everybody listening, Scalp is the French version of the same thing. It's a cruise missile that has incredible accuracy and can go several hundred kilometers.
I
The
see.
US weapon in this sort of category is called a TACAMS. That's an acronym, Army
Say
Tactical Missile.
it again, please, Ben. It's called.
The US version is called ATACMS. It's an
Okay.
acronym, ATACMS, that has, again, this incredible precision out to 300 kilometers. And the German cruise missile is called Taurus, which has about a 500 kilometer range. So, in other words, every square meter of Russian occupied Ukraine, Crimea, Donbass, is in range of these weapons. And so the UK and France both had made the decision months ago to provide their capabilities to Ukraine. And so Ukrainians were able to use three Storm Shadows to destroy the Black Sea Fleet headquarters in Sevastopol, the huge seaport on the western side of the Crimean Peninsula. And then with one other Storm Shadow, they destroyed the dry dock facility at Sevastopol. This is the most important maintenance
Yeah,
facility
I
for
can
the wooden
imagine.
boats there.
I can imagine.
Okay, so because of that vulnerability, the commander of the Black Sea Fleet began to move part of his fleet out of Sevastopol much further to the east to Novorossiysk, which is a real Russian seaport, although it's not the same capability Navy base. The point of all this is when people say, oh, you know, Ukraine's losing or there's no way they can win, I would turn it on its head and say, after 10 years with every advantage, the Russians have lost 330,000 troops, thousands of armored vehicles. They are not making any progress on the ground. The Air Force and Navy are losing, and I don't, and the Russians do not have the ability to knock Ukraine out of the war. And that's without us even committing to helping Ukraine win.
I see what you mean. Just give me some sense of your interpretation of the number which I've read, found on the internet, not necessarily an accurate source, is that around about 70,000 Ukrainian soldiers killed and about 100,000 wounded. And I stress again, I'm not including in these numbers civilians and children. Okay, so again, what's your sense of that number? 70,000 dead, 100,000 wounded on the Ukrainian side.
Yeah,
Because it
I
seems a
think
big disparity.
that. So, in terms of numbers of casualties, the Ukrainians have always protected their numbers. So, what we're reading in terms of Ukrainian casualties are going to be estimates. I have always trusted British intelligence as the best publicly available source for casualties. Because they do really good work to try and confirm numbers. When it comes to vehicles loss, they and Bellingcat both rely on geolocated imagery to confirm destroyed vehicles. On the Russian side, the numbers, of course, are significantly larger. When it comes to casualties, these are important because they are a metric, but I never take any number of killed and wounded from anybody outside of our own as 100% accurate, partly because it's difficult to confirm things when you're talking about in a war zone, in the incredible lethality of weapon systems, when a vehicle is destroyed, do we really know how many were exactly inside that vehicle? It's impossible to know that. And it's also often that two or three different soldiers may claim, hey, I destroyed that tank or I did this, and they would all be correct. But so you could get some redundancy in numbers. And nowadays, so much of the killing is done by long-range precision artillery or rockets or by drones. And so getting these numbers is going to be difficult. And I always assume that unless I see, two boots or the body, that there's going to be some uncertainty about the numbers, which is why I don't put too much emphasis on numbers, except to indicate a sense of scale of the price that's being paid. And of course, what we're all watching, I mean, you can turn on, get on social media anytime, day or night, and see video of Russian troops that are getting slaughtered because they're being pushed into this meat grinder, in the same way that their grandfathers did and their great grandfathers did. The Russian chain of command has zero compassion for their soldiers. Almost all of the Russian casualties come from regions far, far away outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg. I think the Russians are willing to expend lives like this, as well as continue launching multi-million dollar precision weapons against civilian targets in Ukraine to convey to the West that they can do this forever. They actually cannot, but they sense that we are wavering in our support. And so they want to convey that they can do this forever.
What's your reaction to this? The former chief of the UK Defence Staff, General David, he's now Lord Richards. I'm sure you know General Richards. He was on the show a few months ago, and he said, with almost a hint of anguish in his voice, that's what I detected when I sat in front of him. Who plans on a long war, Michael? That's what he said to me. He went on to say that war should be quick and decisive because the pain won't be worth all the agony. Those are his words. But aren't we in fact heading now for a long war? I mean, it's already, as you say, since 2014, How do you see the bigger picture there, Ben?
Of course, he is correct that nobody wants a long war. And unfortunately, we typically end up with a long war because of a couple of significant strategic failures. Number one, we seldom clearly identify the strategic outcome that we desire, not in a clear way. I mean, even today, I think you would have a hard time getting clarity from the President of the United States, the German Bundeskanzler, the British Prime Minister, and other Western leaders. What's in a very specific way, what's the outcome that we desire?
Yeah, General Richards said something along those lines too.
Yeah. So without that, without having a clearly identified strategic objective, it is almost impossible to develop good policies necessary to achieve that objective. And then also, we consistently fail to anticipate the amount of resources that are going to be required and the cost of doing these things. So, because we didn't clearly identify that we want Ukraine to win this war, that they have to defeat Russia, we did not do a we did a terrible job of anticipating how much ammunition would be required, how much equipment would be required, all the stuff that's needed to fight at that scale. So here we are. And now, because we failed to help Ukraine last year, when Ukraine could have defeated Russia, Russia is attempting to wait us out because they see U.S. has elections at the end of this year. Obviously, that's a factor for them and for everybody else. And they see that there is a lot of wavering in the West about, oh, you know, can we just get to a peaceful settlement? So the Russians have made the decision to go for what is perceived as a long war, although I think in their heart of hearts, they know they cannot sustain it themselves. They think that we'll quit before they will. So back to this statement of war is a test of will as much as it is a test of logistics. Clearly, the Ukrainian people and soldiers have superior will to the Russians. You couldn't find 10 Russians that want to be in Ukraine today. They're not defending their homeland. But the will of the Kremlin, which doesn't care about casualties, doesn't care, I mean, this fake election that's coming up on 17 March, you know, they don't have to worry about voters. They're not going to have Russian journalists putting a microphone in their face. Their will, I worry, may be superior to the will of the White House, the Kanzleramt, and number 10.
I'm not trying to split hairs, Ben. But again, in my conversation with General Richards, we touched on this. And do you think that Russia has already been defeated strategically? I mean, he told me that in his view, Russia had been defeated strategically, essentially because the objective on their side was at the very beginning to take Kiev quickly, and they didn't.
I have heard that from General Richards, and who I've known for many years, and he's always been a very generous, tolerant mentor of mine. And I've heard that from General Milley, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs in the U.S. And I've heard that from to be candid, and with all respect, I think that's a meaningless statement. What does that mean? I mean, if we leave, if we quit, if we push Ukraine into some sort of negotiated outcome, did Russia really lose? Because they will not have stopped. The only way that they are defeated is to be, in the old-fashioned way, defeated, to be ejected from Ukraine, to lose Crimea, to go back to the 1991 borders, which they had agreed to, by the way, several times in the past decades. Now, for sure, their defense industry is in tatters. They're having to get ammunition from North Korea, of all places, and drones from Iran. The value of the gas that they are still exporting is way, way, way below what they would have gotten in the past. So they are paying a price, and I doubt many people are going to want to buy Russian produced military equipment anymore because they've seen that the terrible quality
Doesn't
of it.
work.
Okay, so in terms of strategic defeat, for sure they have suffered some prices, but defeat, I would not be willing to say that. What we have got to do though, is to organize ourselves to take on, to help Ukraine. help Ukraine defeat Russia, but also to help Israel destroy Hamas while pushing Israel to accept a two-state solution. All that attack by Hamas October last year was not a coincidence. I mean, Russia's number one most reliable ally is Iran, and Iran has proxies in Hezbollah, Hamas, and Houthis. So what Iran is doing, of course, is helping Russia by distracting all of us and diverting resources from support for Ukraine. And so we've got to organize ourselves strategically to help Ukraine defeat Russia, help Israel, stop Iranian support from of the Houthis for what they're doing that affects all of us because of the disruption of shipping, which raises prices, by the way. And also be able to look to the Chinese and say, we still have the political will, the defense industrial capacity, and military capability to do all of these things, just like FDR and Churchill made that decision in 1941, 42, after almost 3 years of continuous defeat and disaster. They said, here's what's at stake. We have to get organized. And they did.
So you see, clearly you see a much bigger game at play here. My guest today is Lieutenant General retired Ben Hodges, formerly commander of the United States Army in Europe, and nowadays a senior mentor at the NATO at NATO for logistics. And he's speaking to me from Frankfurt via Zoom. Ben, spring in the Ukraine starts around about the 1st of March, 6 weeks away. Now already the mornings are, brighter and the evenings are getting longer. What next in the war? What must Ukraine do, in your opinion, to expel Russian troops from its territory, including Crimea? And realistically, what can it do? And what does it need from the West in order to do it? And are you confident that Ukraine will get the material it really needs?
I think 2024 is going to be the year that the ability to conduct a long war shifts to Ukraine, because I just don't believe that Russia is going to heal itself and get better over the year 2024 unless we absolutely quit and walk away. So I think that there's a sort of urgency in Moscow that they would like to conceal. But the fact that they are not doing a mobilization before this fake election on March 17th, the fact that they are having to increase their purchases of ammunition and even using North Korean, not just artillery ammunition, but ballistic missiles, I think that belies what they really are able to do. On the other hand, I think Ukraine has got three or four major tasks that they have got to accomplish successfully here in the coming months. Number one, they have got to fix their manpower system. They have plenty of people. I mean, they're probably close to 2 million Ukrainian men and women that are military age that are already in uniform or could be in uniform.
What do you mean
But
by system then, Ben?
there's a recruiting, reception, finding people, saying, hey, McKay, you're 26 years old, you're able-bodied, and it's time for you to do your duty for Ukraine. And but McKay says, I'm not going there because the system, there's corruption, not everybody is equally eligible to be drafted, or I have no confidence that I'll be trained well enough before I'm sent into the front, and so on. So it's, I mean, since they don't have universal conscription in Ukraine, they've got to recruit people, and men and women need to be confident that they're going to be properly trained before they're sent into the fight, and that their family will be taken care of if they're killed or terribly wounded. So right now, the system is not functioning very well. That's number one. Number two, they have got to get better at fighting against Russia's superior electronic warfare capability. The Soviets always had better EW, electronic warfare capability, than we did in the West. And I'm talking about the ability to jam communications, to intercept communications, to identify the place from which communications are emanating and then hit it. They've always been better than us, and
so
that is
all the advance of Western technology. The Russians, they're always better than us about in that area, were they?
Yeah, it's not a technology. It's a use of the technology and the creation of the systems necessary to do that. It just
I didn't
was
know that. Okay.
We never emphasized it the way they did, and so it makes it very difficult and dangerous to communicate. For example, or
yeah.
if you rely on weapon systems that are purely GPS for targeting and navigation, that can be spoofed or jammed. So
yeah.
the Ukrainians have got to fix that. They also are working hard now to rebuild their own defense industry. In the Soviet times, Ukraine actually was the heart of the Soviet Union's defense industry. That they've lost that, and they're having to rebuild it. You've got some Western companies that are helping build maintenance capabilities, ammunition production capabilities, et cetera, inside Ukraine. That's going to have to go up. The key, though, is really going to be the delivery of long-range precision capabilities from the West, or Ukraine finally is able to do it themselves. And of course, these F-16s that we've been talking about for over a year, my guess is that they will be employed probably in early summer. I don't know how many they have. The Russians, of course, know that these things are coming. I think the Ukrainians will be pretty smart about how and
just
when.
Tell me again, Ben, what are the capabilities of this F-16, just for people like me who don't have
Yeah.
that in our heads?
Okay, well, the F-16, of course, what makes it so effective is not just the flight characteristics of the aircraft itself, but the radar and the weapons that it can carry.
Yep.
So it will give the Ukrainians a significant increase over what they have now to be able to knock down Russian aircraft, more importantly, shoot down Russian missiles that are launched by Russian aircraft at significant range. So the radar and the range and capability of their weapons is what will make it very effective.
I see.
Of course, this is not a video game. I mean, the Russians will be looking for these aircraft. They have enormous amounts of air defense. And so the Ukrainians, as you know, flying an airplane is one thing. The Ukrainians already have very experienced pilots who can learn to fly the F-16 in 3 months. It's employing it in combat against very, very big, rigorous air defense and being able to get to your target or whatever it is you're trying to do. That takes longer. And I think they'll be very smart about how they do that.
Okay. Tell me, Ben, just give us some insights from your military perspective. What do you think that senior military officers, serving generals and people at that level, and retired generals like you with lots and lots of experience, have learned from this war so far that you haven't already mentioned? Because obviously it's been a learn. I mean, I don't mean this in a flippant way, but the war is a learning experience despite
Sure.
this terrible tragedy of deaths.
Now, I think
And
anybody
destruction.
that in the military profession or that has studied it realizes that you're never ever going to get it exactly right at the beginning. Clausewitz says that the first duty of the general and the diplomat is to understand the nature of the war before you get into it.
Right.
And we almost never fully understand the nature and character of any conflict. And former Secretary of Defense Gates once said that the United States has an absolutely sparkling 100% record of getting it wrong every single time.
He said that, did he? Oh,
at the
God.
beginning, at the beginning of a conflict. The key is how fast can you get it right?
Yeah.
And so, I think that the Ukrainians have proven to be a very quick study at how to make the necessary adjustments. We have learned from them. I've never been under that amount of artillery and rocket fire or had to deal with the electronic warfare, Russian electronic warfare at that level. And of course, the drones have changed the character of war, not the nature of war, but the character of war, that it's very, very difficult to move without being detected.
Yeah.
And so I
And
think...
this method of attack is relatively cheap. Is that not also the case?
Yeah,
The drone
sure.
doesn't cost much money.
Certain types, and now you see individual drones being used like a weapon, going after individual vehicles or even individual people.
Yes.
So that's a different kind of thing. And so, ever since the first two guys ever fought each other, where one guy had a sword and the other guy says, I need a shield."
Yes.
So you've had this that oh, that's the history of warfare. And eventually we'll come up with ways to counter, defeat, or mitigate the risk of drones to some extent, kinetically and non-kinetically. But we're still a ways from that. But we've also been reminded that a big part of deterrence is are the logistics, having ammunition on hand. And no congressman or parliamentarian wants to spend money on something you hope you'll never have to use, right? But if you don't have the ammunition stocks,
Yeah.
the fuel, the stuff necessary, it doesn't matter how many tanks you have or how much artillery you have to have the logistics underpinning that. And so we're having to wake up our industrial capacity. And defense industry is not a charity. They have thousands of employees. They
Yeah.
have very sophisticated supply chains. So it takes time to get that going again, and that's a reflection of political will, because unlike Mercedes, which makes cars and hopes that people will buy them, Rheinmetall or General Dynamics or Oshkosh or Lockheed makes equipment based on orders from governments.
Yes,
So
yes.
that's the difference here. Finally, it still requires talented, hardworking, committed, well-trained women and men to do this. So no matter what the technology is, you have to have well-trained, disciplined soldiers.
Yeah.
Every video, 100%, every video I've ever seen of a Russian tank being destroyed with a turret flying through the air, it was sitting in the open where Ray Charles could have spotted it. It
Yes.
was not properly protected by dismounted infantry if it was moving through a wooded area. So poor tactics, poorly led, poorly trained soldiers will suffer just like they have done for the centuries.
Closing question, Ben. You've already expressed right at the beginning of our conversation your frustration with politicians and governments not, in a way, keeping their promises. But imagine what's going on in your own Washington, D.C., the capital city you probably know best of all. And in this uncertain year of elections, I think you've got a big date in America coming up on the 7th, if I'm not mistaken, of November. What's the mood? As far as you can test it, I don't know when the last time you were there was in Washington regarding the war, and what do you hope for from the decision makers in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah. So November 5th is election day in the
Is the
US.
fifth, is it? Sorry, the
Yeah,
fifth, yeah.
that's okay. No, it will be probably one of the most important consequential elections in our country's history, at least since the election of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
And so of course I can't predict, but that's 10 months from now. That is a long time in American politics. And the first primary is next week in Iowa. This is go all spring. This is going to be going on. Mr. Trump has numerous court cases already happening, and he's going to be doing a lot of work within the American justice system. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that he escapes all of that. I certainly hope not. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that he will be the Republican nominee. Certainly, most people assume that's the case, but there is an awful lot that's going to happen between now and then. And on the other hand, of course, President Biden, who is 83, has got to demonstrate that he is, he needs to make sure he's getting credit for, the remarkable turnaround in the American economy and things that are being done. So he has to make the case. And as always, with an American election, it boils down to turnout. Do people actually
Yeah.
show up? Vote.
Yeah.
If everybody that should be supporting President Biden shows up, he will win. If they don't, it will be a very, very, very close race. It'll come down to a few thousand votes in four or five different states. If Trump is elected, I mean, never in my life did I imagine an American president would question American commitment to NATO. And he did that just again this week, where he would not commit to, of course, U.S. being in NATO. It's unbelievable to me. But that's the case, and of course, that's a gift to the Kremlin.
Ben, thanks for your sobering and straightforward insights, as always, Ben. Let's hope for the best in this new year and an end to the needless slaughter of young military lives and children and civilians too, sooner rather than later. My guest today has been Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, the former commander of the United States Army in Europe. Thanks once more, Ben.
Michael, thank you for this privilege. What you're doing is so important, helping people who take the time to listen to your program to consider what's at stake and why it's worth supporting, helping Ukraine defeat Russia.
Thanks for listening to the McKay Interview podcast, brought to you by Kyoto Japan Automotive Group, a company which I've known personally for over 20 years, and your one-stop shop for tires, batteries, and auto parts. Visit their website at www.kyotojap.com for more details. And you can find more podcasts on Anchor FM. Just Google McKay Interview Anchor FM. Thanks again for listening.